The following tape was recorded at the 1964 Kiwanis International Convention, Los Angeles, California, as a welfare fundraising project of the Vernon, California Kiwanis Club. The Vernon Kiwanis Club has been given the right to distribute these tapes to the Kiwanis clubs and other commercial use of this tape or to play it on radio or television is expressly prohibited without prior approval of the speaker. We thank you for the opportunity of bringing this speech to your Kiwanis Club. Additional copies may be ordered from the Vernon, California Kiwanis Club, 2801 Leonis Boulevard, Vernon, California, at $5 each.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. President, Kiwanians all. I couldn't help but think a moment ago and get a little self-conscious, remembering my own theatrical beginnings in high school theatrics, and then looking at this group of fine young people up here and being very much aware that the world has progressed in these years. You know, I am grateful for all those kind things and undeserved things that were said about me in that fine introduction. On the other hand, I'm a little disturbed by some of the things. In my profession, you get a little self-conscious these days when someone introduces you by referring to the pictures that you've been in. Now, I don't mean that I'm ashamed of everything I've done, but anyone that's been in the picture business for any length of time at all has been in some pictures that the studio didn't want them good. It wanted them Thursday. And in the old days, we could always count on the passing years taking those pictures out of your memories. Now you just stay up late enough at night in front of the TV set and they all come back to haunt us. Sometimes it's like looking at a son you never knew you had. I've got a couple of friends in the business stay up late just to watch their hairline recede. Well, ladies and gentlemen, when I see a group of fine young people, such as we've had here and this fine young speaker who's preceded me, I can't help but feel, as I'm sure you do, a great sense of responsibility, at the same time a great question with regard to what we have done for them and have handed on to them. Now, I'm going to talk of controversial things. I make no apology for that. I only explain it because in this election year, with emotions running a little more high and heated, someone is apt to read partisan politics into almost any statement on the problems of the day. Also, because it's impossible to legitimately debate the issues of the day without being subjected in these times to name-calling and the application of labels. I have talked on this subject for more than 10 years. Obviously, I must have spoken under administrations of both of the major parties. This by way of explanation that I believe the controversial subjects I discuss are partisan only in the sense that the parties take stands on them. In truth, they cross party lines. They are nonpartisan. With regard to the name-calling, those who deplore the use of the terms pink and left-wing and leftist today when those names are carelessly applied are themselves guilty of branding all who oppose their so-called liberalism as right-wing extremism. How long can we afford the luxury of this family fight when we're at war with the most dangerous enemy that has ever been known to man? And if we lose that war, and in so doing lose our freedoms, it has been said that history will record with the greatest astonishment that those who had the most to lose did the least to prevent its happening. Not too long ago, two friends of mine were talking to a Cuban refugee, a businessman who had escaped from Havana. He was telling a pretty horrifying tale And in the midst of it, one of my friends turned to another and said, "We don't know how lucky we are." And the Cuban stopped in his story and he said, "How lucky you are. I had some place to escape to." And he told the entire story right there. Those who seek freedom in the world and try to find it by escaping to our country have come to the last stand, the last defense of freedom. And if we lose it here, there's no place left to go, no place left to find it. James Madison said that we base all our experiments on the capacity of mankind for self-government. It's time we ask ourselves if we still know the freedoms that were intended for us by the founding fathers, and if we still have passed on to these young people the freedoms that we knew in our youth. Because freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. You don't pass it on just in the bloodstream. It has to be fought for and defended by each generation. This idea that government was beholden to the people, that it had no other source of power except the sovereign people, is still today, in spite of all of the talk of a new idea, of new ways to go, of a revolution and a social uprising in the world, this idea that we've known here for almost two centuries is still the newest and the most unique idea that has ever taken place in all of the long history of man's relation to man. For almost two centuries, we have proven man's capacity for self-government. And yet today, we are being told that we must choose between a left and a right, while others present a third choice and say there is some kind of a safe middle ground, some place of moderation in this struggle. You know, I've often thought that if we lived in a country where cannibalism was practiced, a moderate would probably be, an extremist, I should say, would probably be someone who wouldn't eat anyone under any circumstances, and a moderate would be someone who would just eat certain people on certain particular occasions. I would like to suggest to you that there is no left or right. There is only an up or down. Up to the ultimate of freedom consistent with law and order, or down to the ant heap of totalitarianism. And regardless of their humanitarian motives, those who would sacrifice freedom for security have chosen this downward path. Plutarch warned. Plutarch warned that the real destroyer of the liberties of the people is he who spreads among them bounties, donations, and benefits. Well, today in America, there's an increasing number of people who can't see a fat man standing beside a thin one without automatically coming to the conclusion that the fat man got that way by taking advantage of the thin one. So, these people seek all the answers to all the problems of human need through more and more government. One of the molders of public opinion on television, Howard K. Smith, has said that the profit motive is outmoded. It must be replaced by the incentives of the welfare state. He says the distribution of goods must be affected by a planned economy. And one of the articulate spokesmen for this theory, a United States senator, defines liberalism as meeting the material needs of the masses through the full power of centralized government. Well, in the first place, there should be something disturbing to anyone in this country when you and I, the free men and women of this country, are now referred to as the masses. This is a foreign term that we're not used to in this country. But beyond that, the full power of centralized government was the very thing the founding fathers sought to minimize. They knew that you can't control things. You can't control the economy without controlling people. So we've come to a time for choosing. Either we accept our responsibility for our own destiny as individuals, or we abandon the American Revolution and confess that a little intellectual elite in a far distant capital can plan our lives for us better than we can plan them ourselves. And already the hour is very late. The government has laid its hand on health, on housing, on farming, on industry, commerce, and education, and to an increasing degree today is interfering with the people's right to know. Government programs tend to grow. They take on a weight and momentum. As public servants with the best of intentions and the greatest of sincerity say, what greater service we could render to the people, what greater good we could do if only we had a little more power and a little more money. The truth we have to face is that outside of its legitimate functions, and mark that term well, its legitimate functions, government does nothing as well or as economically as the private sector of the economy. We have no better example of this than government's involvement in the farm economy over the last 30 years. Think of it. Today, one-fourth of farming in this country is responsible for 85% of the farm surplus. That one-fourth of farming has seen a persistent and steady decline in the per capita consumption of every product it raises. That one-fourth of farming is regulated and subsidized by the federal government. Three-fourths of farming is out on the open market, governed only by the laws of supply and demand. And that three-fourths of free farming has seen a 21% increase in the per capita consumption of all of its produce. Since 1955, the cost of the farm program has nearly doubled. Direct payment to farmers are 8 times as great as they were 9 years ago. But gross farm income remains the same, and the surplus is bigger. In that same period, there's been a decline of 5 million in the farm population. But there's been an increase in the number of Department of Agriculture employees, to where today there is one such employee for every 30 farms in the United States. And still, they can't understand how 66 shiploads of grain headed for Austria disappeared without a trace, and Billy Sollis has never left shore. Three years ago, the federal government decided to have a feed grain program to control the production of a surplus of feed grains. Now it's 3 years and $2.5 billion later. And the corn crop last year was 100 million bushels bigger than before they started to curtail it. That program prorates out to $43 we spend for every dollar bushel of corn we don't grow. Responsible farmers in the country over and over again have asked the government to return, to adopt a program that would eventually return farming to the free economy. Last year, the wheat farmers voted against Santa Claus. But the government says we know best, and so virtually the same program rejected by farmers is now forced on them in spite of their referendum last year. Meanwhile, back in the city, under urban renewal, the assault on freedom continues. Most people think that urban renewal's attraction to a city or community is the so-called free government money. It isn't at all. Urban renewal's big lure is the fact that the federal government has eroded away the rights that we had under eminent domain, so that public interest is almost anything that a few government planners decide it should be. Eminent domain, the law by which we recognize that there will come times when in the public interest, meaning in everyone's interest, we must take some man's private property for a school, a dam, a highway, some public purpose. But he has his day in court. He has his chance to say that this is not the best way to do the job. And then if he is overruled legitimately in court, a fair price is paid and public use is made of his property. Today, under Senate Bill 628, there is no such thing. Today, the Law Division of the Library of Congress and the General Accounting Office have ruled under this bill that any property, be it private or commercial, can be declared slum or blighted and the owner has no recourse at law, the courts will have to rule against the owner. In one eastern city, 84 buildings were declared sound by the city inspectors, but to get an urban renewal project, The city fathers overruled the inspectors and declared them slum or blighted. And the owners of the property had to watch $26 million worth of property go under the headache ball and be destroyed. And other evil things can enter in. In one eastern city, one man owned a rundown section of the city. He sold his property to Urban Renewal and then submitted his own plan for how it should be refurbished and redeveloped. And the government sold him back his own property for 22% of the purchase price. How many of us realize that the government has now reserved the right to declare slum or blighted areas surrounding a proposed urban renewal project, even if those areas are not slum at all, but they're necessary for the development of the project the planners have decided on? Here in our own vicinity, there is one such area in which to go forward with such a project. They are trying to declare slum and blighted a residential area in which the homes average $100,000 in cost. Now it's announced that we're going to build housing units in the thousands where we've been building them in the hundreds. And FHA and the Veterans Administration reveal that they today are holding 120,000 housing units they have taken back through mortgage foreclosure. Mainly because the people living in those housing units discover, thanks to the easy terms, they now owed more on the property than the property was worth. So one day they just packed up and walked out the front door. Many of those buildings have been bulldozed into the soil. Others, the government has announced it will repaint, polish up, and put back on the market, many of them for $100 down and 35 years to pay. And that'll give the bulldozer a second crack at them. But it's in the area of social welfare that we found government's most fertile growing bed. Most of us accept our responsibility for those less fortunate. You in this convention are living proof of the citizen's acceptance that he is his brother's keeper. So we're susceptible to humanitarian appeals. Federal welfare spending in the last, I should say, is 10 times greater today than it was during the dark depths of the Depression. The combined state and federal and local welfare bill totals some $45 billion in 57 programs run under 12 separate agencies of the government. Now we are told that a fifth of the families in this country are poverty-stricken on the basis of an income of less than $3,000 a year. Do you realize that if we prorated the $45 billion out evenly and gave a share to each one of these so-called underprivileged families, we could hand each family about $4,600 a year, and this would go a long way toward eliminating poverty. Actually, direct aid to the poor averages less than $600 per family. Someplace there must be some overhead. For three decades, we've tried to solve the problem of unemployment by planning. And the more the plans fail, the more the planners plan. The latest is the Area Redevelopment Agency. And in 2 years, less than 0.5% of the unemployed who found jobs could give credit to ARA for finding those jobs. And that program prorates out to more than $5,000 for each job found. But beyond all of this extravagance, what are we doing to the people we set out to help? This should be our prime consideration. A judge called me recently in this town. He thought I might be interested in the type of case that was coming before these people. He said he had just talked to a fairly young woman. She had six children, was pregnant with her seventh, and she came to the judge to discuss a divorce. It became apparent her husband didn't share her desire. So under questioning, the judge said it was revealed that the man was a laborer getting $250 a month. The woman wanted a divorce because she could get an $80 a month raise. By divorcing her husband, she was eligible for $330 a month on the Aid to Dependent Children program. And she'd gotten the idea from two women in her neighborhood who had already gotten rid of their husbands in order to get a raise. Yet any time we question the schemes of the do-gooders, we are denounced, those of us who have been tagged with the right label or the conservative label, as being opposed to the humanitarian goal. They say that we're always against things. We're never for anything. They refuse to meet us on the legitimate argument that we too share their humanitarian desire to do good. We question whether they have always found the right way to do it. It isn't that these people of the so-called liberal philosophy are ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so. We're for a provision, for example, that destitution should not follow unemployment by reason of old age. That's why in 1935 we accepted without question a Social Security program as a step toward meeting this problem. But does this mean that we cannot be against the irresponsibility of those in charge of the program who say that any criticism or suggested improvement means an end to payments for those people who depend on them for a livelihood? We've been told in millions of pieces of literature and press releases in the last three decades that this is an insurance program. But these same people who run the program, among themselves and to the United States Supreme Court, have said that it is not an insurance program. They only use that term to sell it to the people. They have said it is a welfare program and that Social Security dues are a tax for the general use of the government. And the government has used that tax. In the actuarial sense, there is no fund. Now, before Congress, the executives of this program admit to a congressional committee that the program is today $298 billion in the red. Who pays for this fiscal irresponsibility? We'll take another look at the young people who've appeared before you today. Already, the young man in his early 20s going to work at an average salary will find that he and his employer are paying into this program enough money, if it could be given directly to the young man, he could, in the open market, buy a retirement insurance policy guaranteeing him some $220 a month at age 65, and the government promises him $127. Now, are we so lacking in business sense in this country that we cannot make provision for those people that require this program and at the same time introduce voluntary features that would permit the young man who can do better on his own to do so? If it is a welfare program and it can't be both welfare and insurance, couldn't we let all those who show evidence that they have made provision for themselves out? Couldn't we give those who needed a chance to help themselves and at the same time, being our brother's keeper, match them from the public funds with enough money so that they are guaranteed an income when they need it? This isn't an insurmountable problem. Today, there are 30 million of our workforce who are protected by pension plans of unions and industries. And those pension plans are soundly funded with over $70 billion invested in corporate securities and income-earning real estate. I think we're for telling our senior citizens that no one in this country should be denied medical care because of a lack of funds. But again, I believe we can find the answer to this problem without forcing all citizens into a compulsory government medical insurance program, regardless of the individual's need. Now, in passing the bills on as we have to the young people, I shouldn't mean to imply that we have denied all our responsibility to youth. Right now, we're considering a program urged on by the dropout problem and juvenile delinquency. We're talking about a government program to revive something like the CCC camps to help our young people. If you look closely at the suggested legislation, you'll find it prorates out to $7,000 a year for each young person we're going to help. Hell, we can send them to Harvard for $3,000 a year. Of course, don't get me wrong. I'm not suggesting Harvard is the answer to juvenile delinquency. I think it could be safely said that all of us are for an international organization where the nations of the world can legitimately seek peace. But we're against subordinating American interests to an organization so structurally unsound that today you can muster in the General Assembly of the UN a two-thirds majority from nations that represent less than 10% of the world's population. Is there not something of hypocrisy in our country continuing to assail our allies for hanging on to the last vestiges of colonialism while we engage in a conspiracy of silence and make no mention whatsoever of the millions of people enslaved by the Soviet behind the Iron Curtain? I think we're foraying our allies by sharing of our material blessings with those nations which share in our fundamental beliefs. But we're against doling out money government to government, creating bureaucracy and collectivism and socialism in all the countries of the world. We set out after World War II to help 19 war-ravaged allies. We are now helping 107. We've spent $146 billion. Part of that money bought a $2 million yacht for Haile Selassie. Foreign aid bought dress suits for Greek undertakers. We bought 1,000 TV sets with 23-inch screens yet for a country where they have no electricity. And in Kenya, we used government funds to provide extra wives for government officials. When Congress moved to cut foreign aid, they were told that if they cut it by $1, they endangered our national security. And then Senator Harry Byrd of Virginia discovered that foreign aid has rarely in a single year spent its entire allotment of funds. And today, foreign aid has $21 billion piled up that it hasn't spent yet. We could stop appropriating for the next 5 years and they wouldn't have to go out of business. Dr. Howard Kirshner, perhaps many of you are familiar with the story that he has told. Dr. Kirshner was speaking to the Prime Minister of Lebanon. And the Prime Minister of this little country happily told the doctor that his country had no debt, no deficit, balanced its budget every year, had a modest tax rate, no inflation, and it increased its gold holdings in the last few years from $70 to $120 million. And when he'd finished, Dr. Kirshner told him about our country that hasn't balanced its budget 28 out of the last 34 years. He told him how our country has a debt that is greater than the combined debt of all the nations of the world. He told him that our country has a tax rate so high that the percentage the tax collector is taking today from the private sector of the economy is greater than any nation has taken in civilized history and ever survived. And we have lost gold to the point that the solvency of our currency is in danger. And when he finished, he said, "Mr. Prime Minister, do you think that my country should continue to give your country millions of dollars each year?" And the Prime Minister smiled and said, "No, but if you're stupid enough to do it, we're going to keep on taking the money." So in Lebanon, foreign aid built a model stock farm, and we built 9 stalls for each bull. I find something peculiarly appropriate in that. Today, we have $15 billion worth of gold in our vaults, and we don't own an ounce. The dollar claims against it total $27 billion. In the last 6 years, 52 nations have bought $7 billion worth of our gold, and all 52 are receiving foreign aid. Because no government ever voluntarily reduces itself in size, government programs once launched take on a sort of immortality. A government bureau is the nearest thing to eternal life we'll ever see on this earth. The United States government manual takes 25 pages to list every government, every senator, and every congressman, and all the agencies controlled by Congress. And then the manual lists all the agencies that come under the executive branch. And it takes 520 pages to list them. Since the beginning of the century, the gross national product has increased 33 times. The cost of the federal government has increased 234 times. The workforce has only increased 1.5 times, but federal employees have gone up 9 times. There are now 2.5 million. No one knows what they all do, but one congressman found out what one of them does. He found a fellow's job in Washington, and the congressman says this is absolutely true. He sits at a desk, documents come to him, he reads them, he initials them, and he passes them on to the proper agency. One day a document arrived he wasn't supposed to read, but he read it, he initialed it, he passed it on. 24 hours later, it arrived back at his desk with a memo attached. Said you weren't supposed to read this. Erase your initials and initial the erasure. Already we have a permanent structure of government so big and complex it's virtually beyond the control of Congress and the comprehension of the people. And tyranny inevitably follows when this permanent structure of government, frozen into permanency by civil service regulations, cannot be removed by a vote at the ballot box when this structure begins determining government policy instead of leaving this to the elected representatives. As one example of how far we've gone in that, we saw the case of the Congress debating whether to lend the UN $100 million, and the State Department handed the UN $217 million, and the UN used a part of this money to pay Castro's delinquent dues. Under bureaucratic regulations arbitrarily adopted without the wish of the people, we've lost much of our constitutional protections, such as those against search and seizure. How many of us realize that today a federal agent, under many of these regulations, can invade a man's property without a warrant, can impose a fine without a formal hearing, let alone a trial by jury, not for lawbreaking, just for violating a regulation. And if the fine isn't paid, they can seize and sell the individual's property at auction to enforce the payment of that fine. An Ohio deputy fire marshal sentenced a man to prison after an administrative hearing in which the man was not even allowed to have a lawyer present. The Supreme Court upheld the sentence, ruling it was an administrative investigation of incidents damaging to the economy. Someplace a perversion has taken place. Our natural, unalienable rights are now presumed to be divisible by a vote of the majority. The greatest good for the greatest number is a high-sounding phrase, but it is contrary to the very basis of our nation. Unless we realize that government at the same time has no excuse for even existing, unless government is willing to accept that the individual has certain rights which cannot be imposed upon even if he stands alone in the face of all of his fellow citizens. Without this recognition, majority rule becomes mob rule. Now it's time we realize that socialism can come wrapped in an American flag. It can come without the overt seizure of property or the nationalization of private business. What does it matter if you hold the title to your property or business, if the government can dictate policy and procedure and holds life and death power over your business? The machinery already exists. Lowell Mason, the former antitrust law enforcer for the Federal Trade Commission, has said American business is being harassed, bled, and even blackjacked under a preposterous, crazy quilt system of laws. There are so many that the government literally can find some charge to bring against any concern it chooses to prosecute. Are we safe in our books and records? The natural gas producers have just been handed, speaking of records, a questionnaire. It weighs 10 pounds, 428 pages long. Each page has room for hundreds of entries. They have to fill it out in quadruplicate. One firm has said that it will take 70,000 accountant man-hours to comply with this order. The Federal Power Commission says it needs this to see whether they're charging the right price for gas. The NLRB rules that a business firm cannot discontinue its shipping department and subcontract the business out, orders it to reinstitute its shipping department even though it could do the job more efficiently and economically by subcontracting. The Supreme Court rules that the federal government has the right to tell a citizen in this country what he can grow on his own land for his own use. The Secretary of Agriculture asks for the right to imprison farmers who violate planting requirements. A Timken Bearing Company finds that the Bureau of Internal Revenue says its institutional advertising cannot be deducted as a legitimate business expense for tax purposes because what they're saying in their ads are not in the public interest. A child's prayer in school, we're told, endangers our religious freedom. But the Amish people in Ohio find that their religious freedom is endangered. They can't participate in Social Security under the terms and the tenets of their religion. But they've been forced to participate in paying the Social Security tax because the government seized their livestock and sold it at auction to enforce the payment. We approach a point of no return where government is so huge and entrenched that even though we're opposed to the idea, pretty soon we fear the consequence of upheaval. Today, our government accounts for a fifth of the industrial capacity of our nation, a fourth of all of the construction, a third of all of the mortgages in the country are guaranteed or held by government. The government owns a third of the land but asks for millions of dollars to buy additional land for recreational purposes. More than 19,000 businesses covering a half a hundred different lines of activity are run tax-free, rent-free by the government. The Defense Department runs 269 supermarkets. They do a gross business of $730 million a year, and they lose $150 million a year. And the government goes on spending $11 million an hour every hour of the 24, day in and day out. They pretend we've had a tax cut, while at the same time we practice a policy of planned inflation, deliberate and intentional, which in the same period we're given a tax cut will erode the purchasing power of our money through inflation more than the amount that we've been handed through the tax cut. We need true tax reform. We need tax reform that will make a start toward restoring for our children the American dream that wealth is denied to no one, that any individual can fly as high as his own strength and ability will take him. Sumner Slichter, the economist, has said if a visitor from Mars looked at our tax policy, he'd conclude it had been designed by a communist spy to make free enterprise unworkable. But we cannot have such reform while those who engineer the reform are looking toward the tax structure not as a means of raising revenue, but as a means of achieving social reform and regulation in this country. Another senator has said that the tax issue is at heart a class issue, and that the government must use the tax to redistribute the wealth and the earnings of our people downward. When Karl Marx said it, he said, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Have we the courage to face up to the immorality and discrimination inherent in the progressive surtax, to demand a return eventually to proportionate taxation? No nation in history, as I told you before, it survived a tax burden that reached a third of its national income. Today, 37 cents out of every dollar earned in this country is the tax collector's share. Private enterprise produces wealth and government spends it and consumes it. In any system which allows people to rise to the top, some will, of course, drop to the bottom. And the only way you can change this is to, by regulation and law, force everyone to remain at the same level. Freedom has never been so fragile, so close to slipping from our grasp as it is at this moment. I wish I could give you some magic formula. But each of us must find his own role, his own way of serving. There's one man in Virginia, an industrialist with 200 employees, who's found a way, and a number of business concerns have followed his path. He was concerned because his employees had no worry about the cost of government. So he now gives them their full paycheck for 3 weeks of each month, and on the fourth payday, he takes out all of the withholding for the four paydays out of the one check. He's got one employee, has to give him $4.70 every fourth payday. But in about 2 months, he made 200 conservatives out of his employees. Are you willing to take the time and trouble to study the problems, study the issues, to be aware, to convey your knowledge to your friends and your family, to resist the temptation to get a government handout for your community, to realize, for example, that the doctor's fight against socialized medicine is your fight, that if they can socialize him, they can socialize the patient, the government's invasion of the public power field is your fight, that if they can take over this one business, they have started the assault on all other businesses. It's in this election year, regardless of the party of your choice, pin down the individual who solicits your vote as to where he stands with regard to fiscal responsibility and constitutional limits on the power of government. Demand of each candidate that he goes to his official position once elected with the intention of putting an end to deficit spending. Perhaps there are some among you who fear participating. You say that you can't take a stand on the issues because there might be reprisal. Well, if you feel that way, you're just feeding the crocodile, hoping he'll eat you last. But eat you he will. If it seems like too much work, think what's at stake. There can be no security any place in the free world if there isn't economical and fiscal stability in the United States. Those who ask us to trade our freedom for the soup kitchen of the welfare state are the architects of a policy of accommodation. They tell us that by avoiding a direct confrontation with the enemy, he'll learn to love us. He'll give up his evil ways. And all of us who oppose this idea are blanket indicted as warmongers. Well, let's set one thing straight. There is no argument about peace or war. No one should be accused of wanting to send other people's sons to war. We have sons of our own. The only argument is the best way to avoid war. There's only one guaranteed way: surrender. The specter that our well-meaning liberal friends refuse to recognize is that accommodation is appeasement. And appeasement does not give you a choice between peace and war, only between fight or surrender. Oh, they tell us when we say that the problems are too complex for such a simple answer. Well, they're wrong. There is no easy answer, but there is a simple answer. If you and I, once again in this country, have the courage to base our policy and our decisions on those things which we know are morally right, our policy of accommodation asks us to accept the greatest immorality that we could possibly as citizens commit. We are to buy our security by telling those millions of people in the satellite nations to give up their dreams of freedom because we, for our own safety, are willing to make a deal with the slave master. In short, we will recognize the status quo. That's Latin for the mess we're in. Alexander Hamilton said, a nation which can prefer disgrace to danger is prepared for a master and deserves one. Admittedly, there's a risk in any course we follow. Already, some people have hinted what their answer would be if faced with the final ultimatum. If, regardless of the course we follow, we come to that moment of having to choose, the English commentator Tynan has said he would rather live on his knees than die on his feet. And in our own country, we've heard those who say, better red than dead. Are we honestly to believe that nothing is worth dying? If so, when did this begin? Should Moses have told the children of Israel to live in slavery under the Pharaohs rather than dare the wilderness? Should Christ have refused the cross? Should the patriots at Concord Bridge have thrown down their guns and refused to fire the shot heard round the world because nothing is worth dying for? Are we to believe that all the martyrs of history were fools and their sacrifice in vain? You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We can preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we can sentence this generation of young people to take the first step into 1,000 years of darkness. If we are destined to fail, if this way of ours is to be lost, then at least let our children and our children's children say of us that it didn't fail because we failed to try. Let them say that at least we did all that could be done in the one moment allotted us here on earth.